You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the play's The Thing. We'll find out what it takes to bring Shakespeare to life at American Players Theater in Spring Green.
First, in an ongoing series, WPR News is following a class of recruits through the Madison Police Department Training Academy. Today, we look at the use of force at a time when officer-involved shootings across the nation and here in Wisconsin have drawn the public scrutiny.
As Bridget Bowden found out, the use of force is one of the most difficult things to learn and to teach.
On the first day of firearms class, Madison's new police recruits line up in the training center's shooting range. They draw their new handguns out of their holsters and wait for their cue.
Shooters, be alert.
Then they fire.
Threat.
Before the academy, recruit Jessica Gillette had never fired a gun.
The thing that I was most nervous about was how the gun was going to react once I shot it, and the sound. I was really sensitive to the sound and the smells.
She says firearms and defense and arrest tactics have been the most difficult parts of the academy. She often comes early or stays late to get extra practice.
And you want some of those motions and, you know, all the different steps that we do to handle the different shots to come automatic and then to rely on your training and then to not have to think about it.
In the academy, the recruits go through all sorts of scenarios using firearms, tasers, and even their hands. The hope is that when they're confronted with a situation while on patrol, they'll react using muscle memory. But they're not just learning how to use force. They're learning how to make decisions. Officer Chris Masterson is the lead instructor for defense and arrest tactics.
It's really tough to, you know, teach someone split-second decision making. It's really hard, so they have to experience a lot of different things to kind of get there.
So first they start in the classroom. In one exercise, the recruits watch a few videos of police using force. Then they vote on whether they think the use of force was justified. Sometimes they all agree. Sometimes they're split 50-50. Sometimes it's one against the rest. Masterson says it's a good starting point for people just learning these concepts.
It makes for a good conversation, I guess, for the class, because again, you start to hear people say, no, that's bad, no, that's good.
Sergeant Tim Patton is the department's lead recruiter. He says many recruits come in expecting to learn exactly when it's okay to use force and when it's not. But he says it's more subjective than that.
What we all want, I think what we wanted as new recruits who were learning this, is we wanted these bright line rules. If this happens, you do this, and if that happens, you do that, and it just doesn't work that way.
The legal standard for deadly force comes from the 1989 Supreme Court decision Graham versus Connor. It established that officers can use force when it's, quote, objectively reasonable, based on the totality of the circumstances. But Patton says that's really difficult to teach because it relies on individual officers' perception.
And what we see is that two human beings will look at the exact same situation and one will say, yes, I believe I was in imminent danger, and another will say no.
These concepts aren't new for all the recruits. There are 7 former law enforcement officers in the class. Before Nick Cleary came to the academy, he was an officer in Fitchburg. He says experience helps navigate these lessons.
So that gray area never necessarily goes away, but you might understand with experience to shrink that gray area to make it a little bit easier to make a choice.
In the wake of the killings of Paul Heenan, Tony Robinson, and others by Madison officers, the department has come under scrutiny for its use of force. Patton says that's why it's important that the community understand how officers are trained.
We have to be able to better learn from our mistakes so that individual officers and an agency can improve its response to situations. And we have to have better conversations to be able to maybe move more quickly when we see something that the community finds unacceptable.
In our next installment, we'll take a look at how the recruits learn a different dangerous skill, emergency driving. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Bridget Bowden joins us now in the studio with more on the use of force training and her experience with this class of recruits. Bridget, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you mentioned in the story there, of course, we've got this backdrop of police-involved shootings in Wisconsin and around the country. Obviously, police do use of force training all the time, but did you get a sense that, you know, these are people who watch the news, too? They're thinking about these issues out there as they're going through this training.
Absolutely. The scrutiny that police are under right now is heavy on the minds of all of the recruits in the class. I've talked to several people who even considered before they started the academy whether or not they really wanted to enter this field because of those reasons. So definitely they're considering it all the time.
Now, we heard from an officer there who had never fired a firearm in her life before this training. What kind of feeling did you get among the recruits who were there learning to use firearms? Some experienced police officers themselves, to some who have never picked up a weapon before.
Right. There was a real range of skills on the first day of firearms. There were some people who were in the military, some people who have been officers for years and years. And then there were a couple people who had, like you said, never shot a gun before. So on the first day, you could definitely tell that it was some people were nervous. But they've been going through lessons and doing drills, and they're on the firearms range. Actually, this week they went out to the Dane County Law Enforcement Training Center to learn rifle shooting. So, yeah.
And one of the first-time shooters was talking about the sound, the feel, and the smell of the firearm. This is a new and different experience that maybe people don't think about before they pick up a gun.
Right. If you're not experienced at all, which several of these people were not experienced at all with firearms. There are several things to think about. Jessica Gillette, who was featured in the story, she told me that she was really worried about the recoil. She was worried about how the gun was going to react once she shot it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of thoughts.
How much time goes into this kind of training when we count the firearms, the defense and arrest tactics training?
Right. So the academy is 864 hours of training in total. And so of that, 198 hours are tactical training. And so that includes firearms and defense and arrest tactics.
And what are the state requirements on this kind of training as compared to what Madison is doing?
So the Madison Police Academy is quite a bit more time intensive than what the state requires. As far as tactical training, it requires 32 more hours than the state requirements.
Let's talk about this concept of the use of force. I understand that can include a wide range of things.
Absolutely. So the Madison Police Department actually has different policies for use of non-deadly force and use of force. And actually, the use of non-deadly force policy is quite a bit longer than the use of deadly force policy because there are a lot more options. There's pepper spray, a taser, any sort of restraint is considered non-deadly force. So, yeah, they're different.
And it sounds like we heard the officers and the trainers they're talking about. It's not as simple as this situation occurs and this is the action you take. This isn't just about training a set of rules. This is about instilling a sense of judgment, I guess.
Right. So the legal standard that governs use of force is Graham versus Connor from 1989. And basically it says that officers have to be objectively reasonable when using force. So, you know, that is not, that's not black and white. That's a pretty gray area. So they are learning how to navigate that gray area.
In talking to the trainees here, did you get a sense of, I would be kind of nervous, like not going out and having this hard and fast set of rules in my head as I went out onto this job?
It's something that they're definitely thinking about a lot. I think that most of them are hoping that by the end of the academy, they'll be secure enough in their training that they won't be wrecked by nerves, you know, every time they're out on patrol.
In the reaction to the high-profile shootings and other incidents we've seen talk about de-escalation tactics, trying to de-escalate situations to avoid the use of force at all when possible. Is that part of the conversation here?
It is, absolutely. And the MPD is working on a new policy for de-escalation, actually. But yeah, absolutely. You know, how to avoid these situations is part of the conversation and training, as well as how to execute the actual tactics.
And you mentioned a couple of officer-involved shootings that a Madison Police Department officer had been involved in over the last couple of years. Are those particular incidents discussed at the academy with these new recruits to that department?
So I haven't been there when they've discussed the individual incidents, especially incidents that have already been decided on. But I'm not there all the time, so there might be something that I haven't been there for.
And then next up for the recruits and for you, driving training.
Right. So I will actually be heading up to Fort McCoy, where they're going to learn how to drive cars in emergency situations on a track. So that should be really interesting.
We'll watch for your next report. Bridget, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
That's Bridget Bowden, WPR's special projects reporter. She's spending a few months embedded with a new class of recruits in the Madison Police Academy. She talked to us today about teaching those recruits about when to use force.
As the world commemorates the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's death, a new book takes a close look at what it takes to bring the bard to life.
Our next guest spent a season embedded with American Players Theater, one of the country's most highly regarded classical theater companies, and it happens to be tucked away in the hills of Spring Green, Wisconsin.
Michael Lenahan joins us now to talk about his time at American Players Theater, or APT. He's the former executive editor of the Chicago Reader. His new book is called Much Ado, A Summer with a Repertory Theater Company. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Well, Michael, how did you first get this idea to spend a season essentially embedded with American Players Theater?
Well, the season and embedded part, that's sort of my habit as a journalist. I've been a magazine writer most of my career, turned to books a few years ago, but always long, deep stories where I do a lot of hanging out, and embedded is a good word for it.
As you said, you're a writer, you're a reporter, but are you also a fan of APT?
I'm a fan of APT. I'm by no stretch of the imagination a theater expert or a Shakespeare scholar. Just a journalist, a professional amateur, going in knowing not too much and trying to learn as much as I can.
And the play that you focused on for the season that you were embedded was Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, which is considered one of his masterpieces among masterpieces. Why did you pick that particular play?
That was a matter of convenience and luck, I think. The head of the company, David Frank, was directing the Much Ado in the year that I spent there, and it was going to be his last year as the leader of the company. And frankly, he was the guy, one of the people who was most welcoming to me. I wanted to stick with him if I could, and I got to say, knowing what I wanted to write about and how I wanted to write it, Much Ado just jumped out at me as the title of my book right from the minute I saw it on the schedule.
So it's interesting because this one has, it doesn't have twins, it doesn't have shipwrecks, it doesn't have magic. What does it have?
Well, it's a pair of love stories. One represents kind of young love, puppy love, naive love, two younger characters, Hero and Claudio. And then it has two older, wiser people who've been out around the block a little bit, Beatrice and Benedict. And they are probably the original, the madcap, not madcap comedy, but what do they call those?
I think you're talking about sort of the banter, the back and forth.
Yeah, lots of banter, lots of wisecracking and so forth. And Beatrice and Benedict were probably the models for the Hollywood movies of the 30s and 40s, whose genre name I am still not coming up with. But there is... like you said, many of the usual Shakespearean comedy tropes are not there. There's no storm. There's not much mistaken identity. But we have these two couples and lots of Sturm und Drang and lots of deception and wringing of hands. And you won't be surprised to know a couple weddings at the end.
And you mentioned David Frank, who emerges from your book's pages as a visionary and also a source of inspiration, clearly for you, but for the actors involved and the entire theater company. So did you get a sense about how his vision for the play takes shape? That's part of where this kind of magic happens between page and stage.
Yes, he is a very text and language-oriented guy, and you can find him... almost at any time with his nose buried in the text, and he reads it over and over and over again. I had the impression that he had the last tableau of the play in his mind from the very beginning. And it was a tableau that sort of spoke of mature, committed love, not too much of sex, but a very tender and committed embrace. And he wanted the play, I think, to be a little bit more about that kind of serious love than just a lot of froth and funny, which you can play Much Ado that way. But he wanted to go for something deeper, and I think he started with that image. I'm just guessing now. We never talked about this, but I think he started with that image and worked backward from it.
Michael Lenihan is with us now. He's got a new book out called Much Ado a Summer with a repertory theater company. And he's joining us now to talk about his season Embedded with American Players Theater and a production of, you guessed it, Much Ado About Nothing. And Michael, you're right about a scene. I think this is done early on in rehearsal. And it's got two of these characters you're talking about, Beatrice and Benedict. And they've been warring. They're trying to do verbal ninja on each other. And they realize at this moment in this rehearsal that they're in love. Can you tell us about that moment? There was a line that one of the actors says that really caused David Frank to stop and think, whoa, this is a different way you can play this.
Yeah, I think I know the scene you mean. David Daniel, the actor who played Benedict, did something very surprising to everyone in the rehearsal room. When there's a point in the play when he sits down and just professes his love. Now, Shakespeare doesn't say anything about sitting down. Shakespeare doesn't say anything about anything. But when I say David Daniel sits down, that's the move that he chose to do in this particular rehearsal. He was just taking a flyer. And he did it in such a way so that his back was to Beatrice's back. And he says this line, something like, what's the line? Do you have it?
I have it, as a matter of fact.
Thank you.
Because it was so striking. I do love nothing in the world so well as you. Is not that strange.
Is not that strange, right. And he says this, and in the rehearsal, he positioned himself in such a way that he would be speaking to the back of the stage with his back to the audience. The audience would not be able to see his lips move. But it was such a surprise to the director, David Frank, that he started exclaiming before they even finished the scene. And he just couldn't stop talking about how much he loved this choice. It was a way, I think they responded it, he responded it to it in that way because it was a way for Benedict to say his love without being presumptuous. And it was very humble, and he was very vulnerable at this point. And this just kind of rang true to Frank and that kind of love affair that he was trying to develop that was going to end up with this tender embrace at the end of the play.
So there's what happens with the actors. Some of that we're talking about there, but there's also everything else that goes on, and there's a lot of it. And for instance, you visited the wig room. What was that like?
I did visit the wig room. Well, the wig room is one of everybody's favorite stops because it's quiet there, and the three women who usually work there have a nice rapport with each other, and there's a lot of yakking going on there, which is not possible in the costume shop or in the scene shop. There's not a lot of yakking, but the wig room, there's plenty of time for conversation, and it's often of a jocular sort, and they're fun people, and at the same time that they're talking, of course, they're doing this very exacting task of tying wigs onto a mesh, usually one or two hairs at a time.
So they make the wigs from scratch, basically?
Yes, they do. I mean, they have a large backlog of wigs now, and they can use wigs this year that they may have made a couple years ago. But every year there are many wigs to be made, and they do it.
Now, in a sense, at American Players Theater, this is a theater, it has now a smaller indoor theater, but the main core theater that began is an outdoor theater, happens out in the woods, in a sort of natural hollow bats swooping overhead. Mm-hmm. You can see the night sky. You get rained on a little bit if it's misting. Did you get a sense for how that great outdoors feeling had a hand in Shakespeare? Sometimes people talk about this as almost an unnamed character actor at APT.
Yes, sometimes the weather or the night really seems to contribute to the play. I have heard people tell stories about productions of King Lear where the thunderstorm came at just the right time, and it was very magical. And, you know, I think that's the way it was in Shakespeare's time, and it is kind of like a character. It's certainly part of the APT experience, and, you know, they're very frustrated when they get rained out, and it can cost them a lot of money if they get rained out at just the wrong time. And they explored the possibility of putting some kind of roof or covering over the theater so that they'd be able to play in the rain. But, you know, they just never did it because they didn't want to separate the audience from the sky. The sky has got to be there.
Now, as we wrap up just briefly, as the season wound down for you, how would you describe the ingredients that go into the magic of putting on Shakespeare or whatever they're putting on at American Players Theater?
Well, of course, there's a lot of mystical stuff like creativity and art and stuff that's hard to grasp and hard to communicate. But there's also a lot of practical nitty-gritty, you know, building sets and rehearsing. And at APT, it's particularly challenging because, you know, by the end of the season, they're doing 8 shows at a time. A single actor might be in 3 different shows. So that implies a lot of interlocking parts, a lot of logistics that they have to start planning for months and months ahead of time.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Michael Lenihan is the former editor and executive editor of the Chicago Reader, and he's the author of the book Much Ado, A Summer with a Repertory Theater Company. He joined us to talk about his season embedded with American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin.
Milwaukee Public Schools Superintendent Darian Driver this week revealed sweeping plans to improve Milwaukee's public schools. Among the proposed changes are measures like implementing school uniforms, altering the annual school calendar, and making staff changes at low-performing schools. There's also a proposal to make Milwaukee Public Schools the city's sole charter school authority.
The goal is to turn the tide on ongoing problems of the district. According to state exams, only about 20% of the school district students can read at proficient levels, and graduation rates have dropped among all racial groups in the district, and enrollment is down too.
Joining us now is Alan Borsuk, senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School. He writes an education column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Alan, welcome back to the show.
Always glad to be here.
Before we dig into the specifics of this plan, Alan, you've told us in the past you are often skeptical of the big new plan. You've written actually pretty recently this fall that you're skeptical of the idea of the superhero superintendent coming in to save the district. What you've seen of this plan so far, do you think that at least maybe it's not the super plan that's going to save everything, but are there positive steps that can move things forward?
Well, I stand by everything I've ever said. Well, maybe not, but in those cases I do. And I don't think this is a super plan. I think it's a, in comparison with a lot of things that have happened around here, fairly bold set of ideas, and I give Dr. Driver credit for floating them and really trying to address some needs of kids in the city, both within MPS and even a little more broadly. It's not the revolution, but there's some interesting ideas in there, and just what will actually happen, of course, is the real question. It's one thing to have a brainstorming session. It's another thing to make real change.
Right. These are all, a lot of these are things that she herself can't do on her own, and the district itself, a lot of things require some kind of approval from the state legislature or the Department of Public Instruction. Is that right?
Well, there are several different ideas that are floating here, and even changing the start date might require legislative approval, depending on how you do it. There's some loopholes, but the prevailing law in Wisconsin is that you can't start school before September 1st, and she's been quite committed to that. And certainly anything that involves the independent charter schools and the private voucher schools, MPS can't do much about that without major change. And those are the elements of the plan that I think are least likely to fly. But things like uniforms and especially some more energetic steps to deal with schools that have chronically low scores, such as working with principals, changing staffs, more targeted professional development, those are things entirely within MPS's control. So those ought to be able to happen.
And let's make that our starting point, this idea of changes at underperforming schools. This comes after there was a state effort to, in essence, take over some of those schools. It looks like that's not happening now. Can you talk about what kind of schools are we talking about? How bad are things, and what would change based on what Dr. Driver has said?
Well, there's a lot of layers to answering that. The main feature of that law that was passed in the spring of 2015 involved turning a handful and then a growing number over the years of low-performing schools over to an independent body under the control of the Milwaukee County Executive. And that didn't fly at all. It never got off the ground. Other aspects of that law are having some impact, you could argue. But nonetheless, the law as a whole was a failure. So I would put some context here that come next spring and the new state budget, Republican leaders have already said several times they're going to take up MPS issues. Everything's on the table is a phrase that's been used. Some of what MPS is doing now, what Dr. Driver is advocating, in my mind, has to be put in that context, that it's a strategy to try to say to the legislature, hey, we're doing things, we're taking new action, we're taking our problems seriously and addressing them, so ease up on us. I think there's a political aspect to this, which isn't to say there isn't an entirely educationally defensible aspect of addressing your problems, but there's a lot of politics going on here.
Right. As you evaluate this still relatively new superintendent in the scope of things, is she someone who can work with Republican lawmakers who, based on what happens on Election Day next week, may still be really big stakeholders here?
Oh, I think there's almost no question that no matter what happens, the Republicans are still going to be holding all the cards come next spring in the state budget process, both the governor's office and the two houses of the legislature. Dr. Driver, who is still young, I believe she's 38 currently, I think that's right, she's under 40 for sure. Very smart, very good at dealing with people, warm, challenging at the same time. She's the one person around here who everyone speaks well of, and I hope means it, including the Republican leadership. So she's the best vehicle that MPS has to ride on here is pushing her ideas, pushing her out in front of the public more, and using what her ideas as a selling point, saying we're on the move here. And yes, I think she's very capable of working with the Republican leadership, and she's got pretty good relations with those leaders and with the business community here and so on. So she's a big asset to MPS at this point, and I think the school board knows that.
Talking to Alan Borsuk from Marquette University. He writes about education, has done so for some time now for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at new proposals from the superintendent of the Milwaukee Public School District. Wide variety of suggestions. Let's look at another one of those. Creating, Alan, an Office of Black and Latino Male Achievement. An office can do a lot of different things, but I want to turn to this focus, Black and Latino Male Achievement. Is that seen as one of the biggest disparities in education, male boys, black and Latino boys in schools?
Well, let's make it clear we're talking in broad terms, because there's African-American males and Hispanic males that are doing great. There are white males that are doing bad. But if you look at the overall statistics, yes, absolutely. The statistics, especially for African-American teenage boys in Milwaukee, are shocking. They're among the worst in the country. The gaps between blacks and whites and graduation rate and reading scores and so on are among the worst in the country, if not the worst in the country, depending on which year it is and which test it is. And boys are doing worse than girls overall. So that is a really, really sore point. There's just a huge need to be addressed there. What would be proved by creating this office would depend entirely on what actually happens. Again, the gap between saying we're going to close this gap and actually closing this gap is, those are two different stories.
Now, here's a different one, school uniforms. Now, as someone who produced talk radio shows about 15 years ago, this was a hot topic, a hot debate. People were really up in arms on one side or the other of the idea of requiring school uniforms in public schools. This is something that Dr. Driver has suggested. Is there an appetite for this in Milwaukee schools?
I would say yes. Frankly, a lot of education policy stuff is pretty boring and doesn't connect with kids and parents. But school uniforms, what am I going to wear to school today? That's something everyone relates to. There are a lot of private schools in Milwaukee and charter schools, and there are even a few schools in MPS that do have uniform requirements. In the case of the public schools, they can't require any kid to do it, but they can make it a big selling point. And schools that have done it, the compliance is pretty high. We're talking about polo shirts and khakis. We're not talking about sports coats and ties. But nonetheless, it creates an environment, the argument goes, where kids aren't worried about what they're dressed in. It's simpler. It creates a school spirit. Generally, it's been popular in schools where it's been done, both with parents and with kids. Sometimes, especially older kids, gripe about it a lot, but actually seem to like it. So overall, I would say this would be a popular idea. Are there people who would disagree with that? Absolutely. And there may be entire school communities which would disagree with it, but overall, that's a popular move.
We're looking at proposed changes to the Milwaukee public school system with Alan Borsak, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think about the superintendent's proposals for overhauling Milwaukee public schools? What's your take on the idea of changing the annual school calendar or having students wear school uniforms? And what do you think would help Milwaukee schools? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about sweeping changes to Milwaukee public schools proposed this week by Superintendent Darian Driver, and we want your take on this. Do you welcome this proposal to make Milwaukee public schools the sole chartering authority in the district? And what about plans to create an Office of Black and Latino Male Achievement? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or send a tweet to @CentralTimeWPR.
Alan Borsak stays with us, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School, education columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We'll go right to a caller with Leslie on the line in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Leslie?
Well, I just wanted to say that I've always been a supporter of school dress code or uniform for Milwaukee public schools, because I always felt that with it being that way, what it does is that when kids come into the classroom, that's just one thing that's a less of a distraction from them from the classroom environment, that they're not focusing on who has what. They're focusing on the lessons. Plus, also, like, as one role block or barrier that's eliminated for people who, or maybe families of low income or what have you, that may not feel like, I don't have the means to, you know, buy all this stuff for my kids to attend school or have them feel a certain kind of way when they attend school. But I've always felt that was something that I was hoping that would have been done a long time ago versus what's being done now. But I'm happy to see that it's on the horizon, hopefully.
Leslie, thanks for the call. So, Alan, a school dress code as one less distraction and a status equalizer, it sounds like. Is that another part of the argument in favor?
Sure, and a lot of parents, a lot of teachers would agree with that. I went hunting a few months ago looking for research on this, and I didn't find much. So I don't know how much there's any firm basis for saying this improves student achievement or anything. It's more like, how do you think it works in your own school or with your own kids? A lot of support for it, though.
Thanks a lot for that call, Leslie. Before we go back to our callers, Alan, one of the last times I talked to you about Milwaukee schools, one idea that was out there was trying to view Education Milwaukee as, you know, one school system, public, charter, voucher, you name it. And some of Dr. Driver's proposals inch along those lines. What did you think what she had to say about where there could be coordination between the public schools and the other schools?
I think it would be a big step forward for Milwaukee as a whole if everyone collaborated more, worked together more, and fought less. So to that degree, I'm eager to see it. The idea of all the charter schools being turned over to MPS and some of the other things, there might be some progress and there's some steps there, but there's a lot of history here, and it's not going to be easy to change. And I'm not sure whether it's a good idea to change or not, but to work together and to hold all kids to high standards, these kind of things. There are places in the country where the climate is much better than Milwaukee on these issues, and we ought to try to emulate some of those places. Denver is one that's often singled out.
Back to our callers now with Muhammad in Chicago. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What did you want to talk about?
Well, I think all the ideas that's been presented from the school superintendent are very progressive, and I think it would benefit Milwaukee greatly. I'm one who advocated uniforms years and years ago when I was in Detroit, and the reason we came up with that is because kids were killing kids over shoes and clothes and coats. That's not happening now, thank God. But uniform is a great idea. It changes the attitude when the child goes to school. You know, it changes where, you know, the standard of excellence is a clean shirt. So you teach your boys and your girls to clean their uniforms, their white shirts, and that's it. The idea about the young black males and Latinos, definitely have to get a group on that and a focus on constructive education. That's my comment.
Muhammad, thanks a lot for that call. He likes most of what he's hearing so far. And Alan, I know these ideas were just presented a couple days ago. They'll be formally introduced, it sounds like, over the course of the next year in various ways. But are you seeing positive responses like that one from Muhammad?
Well, I'm sure that's out there. But, yes, there's been no formal action. In fact, these ideas came out of a informal board session to discuss long-term ideas with no action taken on Tuesday night, and almost nobody was there. So it's going to take a while to roll this out. And I think, again, the political context of rolling it out is going to be something to really keep an eye on. So what will actually evolve, I don't know, but I think certain things like the uniforms will hit a real popular chord.
Muhammad, thanks for that call. Alan, one more point that we haven't dug into yet. Changing the school calendar, starting significantly earlier, it sounds like, ending a little earlier, and then adding a five-week session, kind of a catch-up period, I guess, for students who need that. What do you make of that?
Well, I know Dr. Driver feels that this would be a big plus, and among other things, there's ways that this could be done that would save MPS a lot of money and busing, staff training, some other things that are staggered out at different schools that have different timetables. It would require potentially a change in state law, which requires schools generally to open no earlier than September 1st. I love this piece of history. That was a law that was handled through the tourism committees and not through the education committees when it passed the legislature almost 20 years ago, because it was really done to encourage vacationing and to keep high school kids working in hotels and resorts until Labor Day. Dr. Driver thinks it would be a big help to start a little earlier. I'm a little skeptical, but only in that I think the real issue would be, would it add days to the school year? And at this point, no one's proposing that. If you have 180 school days, I don't know how much difference it makes how you spread them out. So we'll have to see on that. In most places in the country, school starts before September 1st.
Alan, just a few moments left. Is there an appetite for change in Milwaukee schools such that people, even people on different sides of the political aisle, might be able to get together behind some of these proposals?
Boy, that is exactly the question I would have. I think yes, but any change is hard. And changing a system as big as MPS and where the politics are so entrenched between the voucher people and the public school people, the union people and the business people and so on, is very, very hard. So I don't know what the appetite is, but I certainly think that's something that we all need to keep an eye on.
We'll leave it there. Alan, thanks as always.
Glad to be here. Thanks for your interest.
That's Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School, education columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.